that might be for good or bad reasons. I mean, if the reasons are too bad, that might be a sort of instability of your theory. And an example I'm thinking of here is that of space-time dimension in non-perturbative quantum gravity, which we've learned can just become dynamical because of short scale fluctuations and can give values that deviate from those of the classical theory. Now, lastly, there may be things of the classical structure we're not at all kind of putting into our formulation of quantum gravity, but which are regained dynamically, or we hope they will be regained dynamically. So that's often called emergent, or at least that's one way of thinking about emergence. And here I'm thinking of, imagine you're doing kind of non-perturbative Euclidean quantum gravity, where there is no notion of time, so time is also just equivalent to space direction. You can certainly study such models and then hope that maybe, in some suitable limit, things like time and causality will emerge, perhaps at just a sufficiently large scale. Now, so summarizing what I've been saying, so apart from distinguishing different quantum gravity approaches by the choices of elementary degrees of freedom they make, and of course the way they think about imposing quantum dynamics, different approaches can be distinguished by how much background structure they use. So, and there's this classic hierarchy that's often cited. So, which of these metric, differentiable, manifold, topological structure, dimension, etc., is kind of fixed a priori, subject to the qualifications I made on the previous slide, and which of them is part of dynamics. And of course, also what extra structures, maybe symmetries and assumptions, you introduce into your theory. Now, this is what we are mostly playing around with, and we hope to deduce, kind of from what works and what doesn't, something about quantum gravity proper. And this is, there was a question that came up in the Astrid asked us in the panel discussion the other day. Now, what's the right balance between not putting in too little, kind of in the quantum theory, so that you never get to anything that resembles classical GR in some limit, and putting too much, I mean, overloading your theory with structure and adding some biases so that you also don't end up with anything that resembles gravity and quantum gravity. And it's a difficult question to answer, and you know, we have just bits and pieces of evidence. It will be somewhere in the middle. So contributing to this general discussion in my talk today, I will examine a piece of what you might call background structure that appears in CDT quantum gravity, and will actually show that it's one of the things that appear with hindsight to perhaps be dispensable. It's based on very recent work I did with my PhD student, Samuel Jordan. One short version with the main, amongst the main result has come out in this preprint in May. It's published in Physics Letters. And this week, Tuesday, we had the big juicy paper of 44 pages to back up all the details. So please go and look there if anything remains unclear in my talk here. Now, why should you be bothering at all about this approach to quantum gravity called causal dynamical triangulation? So for one thing, it provides kind of a proof of principle how, from a completely non-perturbative and background-independent formulation, you can get just by superposing quantum fluctuations in a non-perturbative path integral, you can generate something, tuning certain parameters in the right way, that resembles, on large scales, a classical geometry, and more than that, a solution to the classical Einstein equations. And here's the little pink universe that stands for kind of the fact that we get out in three and four dimensions from CDT, something whose shape very accurately matches that of a classical De Sitter space. And CDT is currently the only candidate theory of quantum gravity where this has been seen and derived kind of really from first principles. That's a good place here to mention my other main collaborators, none of whom is here actually, so it's Jan Ambjörn, Timothy Budd, Andre Görlich, and some who I have already mentioned, and Jerzy Jurkiewicz. And I should also say there are a couple of young people who are giving CDT talks at this conference in the parallel session. So I recommend you to listen to Joshua Kupermann's talk. There is no conflict with causality, although it happened already on Tuesday, because you can just look it up on pilsa.org, where all our talks are stored wonderfully. And this afternoon there will be a talk by Lisa Glaser on developments in two dimensions. Now, here is my summary slide, really of kind of a short version of the priors, assumptions, ingredients I use to produce kind of the results I talk about later. So this is just the general setup of the approach. There are rather few of those ingredients. So we rely on the quantum superposition principle in the sense of finite path integral, really. We rely on, you know, at least on the phase of things, locality and causality, in that we put in kind of a local version of the action. And note that we are not doing Euclidean quantum gravity, so we really start out by doing a path integral over Lorentzian spacetimes, not over Euclidean spaces. There is a notion of a proper time that appears in this approach, about which later much more. There is also a notion, a natural notion of Wick rotation that exists and will also persist in kind of the generalized version of CDT I'll discuss today. And otherwise, we are merely using kind of standard tools of quantum field theory to evaluate the path integral. What is key here is a certain, discretization is the wrong word, but we are an approximation we are making to describe the space of all geometries, and we describe it as a space of all piecewise flat spaces, which we build by gluing together triangles in two dimensions, in higher dimensions. We glue together four-dimensional simplices, and of course, using these building blocks has already appeared in various other of the approaches we heard about at this conference. I then, in the end, so I really treat that, however, like a in the spirit of standard quantum lattice field theories, that I consider that as a regularized version of the theory. So here is, say, a triangulated torus that would contribute, say, in the Euclidean path integral of this type in two dimensions, so very wiggly object in general. So I'm treating this as a regulator, and which also entails that in the end I'll take a continuum limit of it, in which I let the regulators, say, shrink away. So that is, say, the length of the triangles is characterized by some proper distance, and I ascend this to zero in the limit. So that's my aim. That helps me in ensuring that the construction is reasonably robust, and something I always, of course, have to check in detail, that universality has a chance of being correct. That means the independence of the final results I'm obtaining for the case that there is a can show that is there is a continuum theory that analyzes that, independence of various kind of ad hoc ingredients like details of that regularization I've chosen. What is also crucial for me to derive this result is that I have a non-perturbative computational toolkit available that enables me to generally say something about the path integral and also to say something about observables. And really to extract quantitative results, that is numbers. Now, this is kind of, you know, the list of key results, which I will not really touch upon for the most part in the rest of my talk. So the dynamical emergence of space-time from the CDT picture that I already mentioned, that had to do with the de Sitter nature of the shape of the universe I can get out. Then there is this scale-dependent dimensionality. In this case, for instance, of the spectral dimension one can look at, and Steve Carlett will say much more about it in his talk tomorrow. The CDT systems, like earlier systems without the C, so just dynamically triangulated systems, which were of Euclidean nature, they have a non-trivial phase structure, which you understand quite well. And the news of kind of a couple of years ago was that the CDT approach in four dimensions appears to have a second order phase transition. Now, what you see here is a little bit a piece of a causal triangulation. And you can already distinguish here some features from a generic Euclidean object. Namely, I have kind of a layered structure. And this is what I'll zoom in on for the rest of my presentation. Namely, I will look at how kind of this slice structures is really very closely related to a notion of time, of proper time, of the regularized version of the path integral histories, I'm summing over, and is related or can be, in this case, actually be disentangled from the causal structure I'm opposing on these objects. So when I distinguish here between causal, which is kind of a code word for Lorentzian, you might say, and Euclidean, I mean there is really kind of an overall flow of time. And what in particular I'm not allowing is that the individual space-time histories entering into the path integral change their topology as a function of time. I mean, whichever choice of time you may want to make. So it's not, you cannot have kind of these branching out baby universes which you find all over the place in these Euclidean approaches. Now, so what's the central object of our desire? Fay already flashed it this morning and called it a statement of intent. Now, here is a precise definition of what, in my context, I mean by the gravitational path integral. So the formal sum of all, I mean, integral over all geometries has been replaced by a discrete sum over inequivalent triangulations, which are called capital T, taken from some space of triangulations where, well, here, I mean, schematically, this little A stands for my UV regulator, the thing I want to take to zero in the end. N stands for the number of building blocks, which in the end I want to send to infinity. Here is a simple measure factor. This usually, well, let me not explain what this is. It's almost always one. And then here I have the usual, I mean, complex phase factor, e to the I, classical action. And what I use for the action is Regis implementation for piecewise linear geometries of the Einstein-Hilbert action with a cosmological term. So to start with here, I have two constants, Newton's constant Gn, and the cosmological constant. Of course, in this context, to start with, they're just bare parameters I'm putting into my regularized model. And they will, of course, eventually have to be renormalized. Now, so these are the ingredients. Each triangulation T represents now a distinct curved space-time consisting of n of these triangular building blocks called simplices. And these geometries, as I already mentioned briefly, have the nice property that there exists a definite prescription of Wick rotating them to a Riemannian space, which then converts neatly these complex weights into real Boltzmann factors. And I can then study this object in higher dimensions numerically with the help of Monte Carlo simulations. And it turns out that is currently really the only way to get to grips. I mean, we're getting some numbers out, really understanding what these objects mean as function of these bare parameters. As I already said, the causal structure here of the individual histories I'm putting in there turns out to be important. So it's kind of a relevant ingredient of this path integral. Whether or not I make them causal just changes the final result, so changes the associated continuum theory. And just doing that, I mean, ignoring causality and ignoring the fact that there's a time, so doing everything in Euclidean signature from the start, you don't get any sensible classical limit out. And that's kind of an old result. So CDT, original ambition was to improve on that. And well, after trial and error, we found that making things causal appears to do the job just right. Now, the important thing is now here, how is causality actually implemented in the CDT histories? it's really enforced through a preferred slicing of these simplicial objects. And it appeared already in the on the previous slides, this picture I showed of a little piece of CDT geometry. So you have really a sequence of triangulated manifolds, which you think of as triangulations of space, 3D space. And then you connect adjacent slices of that type with the help of four-dimensional simplices. So you fill out kind of sandwiches of this type, and you stack them on top of each other. And in terms of kind of the causal properties of the resulting space-time, that really means some rather strong form of causality. I mean, something you might like to think of as, you know, global hyperbolicity, some kind of direct product structure with respect to this Lorentzian structure. So, and coming with this slice structure, there is an associated preferred proper time, a discrete proper time, which just is, you know, labeling the individual slices, 0, 1, 2, 3. Of course, there's a question, what is this time? What role does it play? Does this preferred time and the associated foliation affect in any way my final results? Now, I want to emphasize, we're not dealing with a gauge choice because we have no coordinates anywhere. So what do we know about the continuum interpretation of this discrete proper time? Well, the only thing we can really say about it is that when we look at the dynamics of the global scale factor, you know, kind of the cosmological, just the size of the universe, we can, this de Sitter matching takes place by interpreting the continuum version of this T as proper time, or at least proportional with a constant, fixed constant of proportionality to proper time. So we are fairly confident that kind of in some average sense and on large scales, this has an interpretation of proper time, but there is no claim here that this retains any physically interesting or distinguished character on small scales, say. What? Of a freely falling observer. Or, of course, a whole bunch of them, if you like. To the extent, I mean, these continuum smooth concepts make sense in these highly singular piecewise flat geometries. So definitely on each individual building block, the proper time is just, really is the proper time. But the question is, what does it become in the continuum limit? Now, so the question of the preferred role that might perhaps skew my results in some way and should maybe be amended has been asked previously and also addressed in concrete pieces of work. So I want to point to a couple of publications, one of them by Fortini Markopoulou and Lee Smolin, and very closely in time, their collaborator Tomasz Konopka. And what they did, they didn't really relax the slicing, but introduced kind of a new continuous parameter. I mean, roughly speaking, that some kind of you know, lapse, variable lapse, that allowed you to interpret that these two slices don't have just exact distance delta t equal to one, but, you know, can have some variable relation to each other. So the foliation itself wasn't really touched. Also, they didn't. Then they argued that these changes they introduced thus wouldn't make a difference for the continuum limit. What I'll show you today is that we can have a generalization which stays purely within the logic and kind of the construction of CDT by not introducing additional new continuous degrees of freedom, but sticking with triangulations. And it allows you to disentangle the causal structure from the preferred time, notion of time. So what I'll present to you is a version of a path integral where I can still claim that my individual histories are causal, but they do no longer possess a preferred foliation or time. And then we'll see what we get. So it's, of course, always easiest to explain the gist of the idea in low dimensions. And the simplest non-trivial case to do that is in two dimensions. So I'm now talking about a new version of CDT quantum gravity without distinguished foliation. So let me explain the basic idea in 2D, and later let's look at the implementation of the idea in the full kind of setting of a higher dimensional model. Now, first let me remind you, while we all love to have times, a notion of time around, it enables you, for example, in standard path integral formulations to derive propagators, which here I've indicated satisfy this characteristic composition properties that if you split up a time interval little t into pieces t1 and t2, then the propagator satisfies this relation here. Now, proper time, of course, I'm working just in pure geometries, so I don't have any coordinates to start with. From that point of view, proper time is a natural geometric choice, you could say. But of course, you could imagine others. But this is the one we make in standard CDT. And as I've already said, the slices of constant proper time coincide with simplicial submanifolds consisting of purely spatial d minus 1 simplices. Now, we are in two dimensions. In my simple toy example here, these are the usual Minkowskian building blocks of CDT. They have one space-like edge and two time-like edges of equal length. And of course, once you know the edge length, you know the interior geometry, and therefore you also know where the light cone goes. So and it goes like here. Now, the idea is now, the rule is to stick these things together in a layered structure like here. So that, as I was saying before, they're really these two-dimensional building blocks that interpolate between these spatial triangulated spaces. And of course, here, space is something extremely simple. It's just a one-dimensional line, or usually we cyclically identify them. So it's an S1. And the only dynamical variable is kind of the length, so the number of links at each fixed discrete proper time t. So you see what happens when we remove all the time-like links from this picture. You retain the strictly foliated structure of CDT that is so characteristic for it. Now, how am I proposing to relax this? I will introduce another Minkowskian building block. So again, just think of it as a piece of, cut out of flat Minkowski space. I make use of the very same edge length. So here I have now the new building block. It has two space-like edges of the same length as this guy here, and it has one time-like edge. And of course, fixing those, the length of those, immediately tells me everything about the interior geometry. So here I've drawn the light cone for you. And that's all, of course, you need to know in 1 plus 1. Now, what I now propose to do is use these two types of building blocks to build my space times. And when I do this, well, there's a little piece of space time here. The only thing I have to pay attention to is to glue time-like to time-like and space-like to space-like and obey local manifold conditions. Now, it turns out that a general gluing of these two building blocks will violate causality in a strong, already local way because the light cone structure at vertices will not be the correct one. So here is a picture of where it is correct, but let me zoom to the next slide to explain to you what goes wrong. So here you see three distinct gluings from my two building blocks. That's the old CDT one, that's the new one. And here I've put them together. Well, according to my gluing rules, there is nothing wrong with them. But when I now study where the light rays go through the vertex, the central vertex, I find here, well, there is only a single light cone. So by one light cone, I just mean, a pair of forward or backward directed light rays. Here, so this is no good from the local point of view of the local Lorentzian structure, causal structure. Here I have a gluing, where I have three light cones, which is also no good, but this is good. So what I'll do is to allow only gluings where the light cone structure is correct everywhere. And the only place where I have to pay attention to in 1 plus 1 is really at the vertices. So, and this piece here shown here does satisfy this, but you'll also see that if I now remove all the red lines, which were the time-like edges, nothing like a nice layered structure is left in general. So you will get kind of bubble structures and these space-like chains of space-like edges, you know, they form, I mean, they can branch. So that's a general thing. And there is, ergo, there is no nice, neat notion of discrete proper time, which I had in the standard foliated case. Now, so that's the general idea. What we'll do now is to implement them in a context which is not 4D, which we'd like to do, but which is 3D, which is the first kind of non-trivial case where also we don't really have access to analytical results. Now, why 3D? The computational complexity of this generalized model turns out to be really formidable already in three dimensions, and that mostly has to do with the implementation of the Monte Carlo moves and the way that a local geometry, which you need to describe and understand as part of implementing these moves, becomes already very complicated with the new building blocks. We also found that the simulation times are extremely long. So already in 3D, this is quite a step up from the standard model. It's more complicated. What is more important is that very similar large-scale properties, like those we've seen in four dimensions, also have been seen in three dimensions previously. And the main one I'll be interested in is the emergence of the Euclidean de Sitter universe, so which we've also seen in 3D. And for instance, Benedetti and Hansen's paper has looked at in relatively recent times. Another reason, which I put here, just to give me an opportunity to mention a really nice work that's been done very recently in 3D CDT, is various ideas that have come from the Pan-Californian collaboration, the many author paper here on this Hojava CDT, but there are also, in proper CDT, is a very interesting new paper by Cooperman and Miller dealing with spherical CDTs, but looking specifically at boundaries, and a paper by Timothy Budd and myself, where we look at toroidal slices and also try to understand the dynamics of kind of going beyond the Friedmann factor, going beyond the scale factor, looking at global Thule geometric modes. Okay, now, so we'll be placing ourselves into three dimensions, play the same game. The task is now, you just take two edge lengths, one space-like, one time-like, and look at all tetrahedra you can construct from these edge lengths, and then you select the ones that have the correct Minkowskian signature. So there are, in total, 11 different types you can construct. They're all here. So the space-like links are, again, marked in blue, the time-like ones in red. And the length assignments, following standard conventions of CDT, I choose to be, I call L space squared for the space-like link. So let this be set equal to my UV cutoff parameter A squared. And the time-like links I express through those here by introducing a positive constant, which I call alpha. So these are, by definition, time-like. So the L time squared is, of course, negative. Now, there are actually four Minkowskian building blocks, but not all of them are Minkowskian for all values of alpha, only the four yellow ones I've marked here. And these will be the building blocks I will now use for my generalized, non-foliated version of CDT in three dimensions. Now, of course, you see, we've thrown away our T, you know, which was kind of a very handy ingredient to have in foliated CDT. So now I have to work harder in order to reconstruct what I mean by time. So I have a universe, and of course, there are various ways in which I might now reintroduce time. So let me first say something about the space-time topology we have chosen. As usual, if you like, it's a finite interval for kind of in time, 0, 1, times S2, compact slices. This is kind of the standard simplest topology. But what we actually do and what turned out to be very convenient is to pinch off this cylinder at the final and an initial point, so effectively making our space-times to have a S3 topology. The time coordinate then we introduce on individual histories of this type is kind of an averaged proper distance from the pole, and we symmetrize this. So the time coordinate of a vertex V in this triangulation is d arrow up of V, so which is the average length kind of future-oriented path from V to the north pole of the three-sphere, minus d arrow down of V, so which is the same thing with the distance from the south pole. I give you a few examples to illustrate or to give you a flavor of the richness geometrically of this new setting in three dimensions. So here there are some new Monte Carlo moves you're introducing in order to manipulate to make our random walk through the ensemble in the Monte Carlo simulation. So that's what we call a bubble move. So you see here this is a single time-like link there which collapses to a disk and their generalization. So this violet thing means it can be red or blue. Then there's a pinching move where you have two disks in this manner and you let them coincide. And then we have a way of moving the north or the south pole around, which is implemented by that move. So that's a very complicated and long story, and Samuel Jordan really spent a lot of his time on getting this going. Now, we then simulate the system, and what comes out is a first characterization in terms of the usual kind of phase diagram. Now, we have two constants floating around in our formulation. So one of them, we are fixing all, as usual, our simulations to fixed space-time volume. So there is no lambda. And we have then, therefore, left over a k, which is the inverse Newton constant. And we have this parameter alpha, which gives this relative scaling between time and space. So it has now become negative here because I've Wick rotated. For the Wick rotation to exist, actually, certain inequalities have to be satisfied, which means we are really interested in this strip of this two-parameter space, which is marked here in green. And what we then look at is primarily the dependence on the inverse Newton constant. So that's the constant we expect things will depend on in an interesting way, and they do. So what we do here, in order to understand kind of phase structure, we move along this line. And I should say this corresponds to alpha equal to minus 1. So in the Lorentzian version, that would be alpha equal to 1. So equality between both directions in the regularized theory, just to give you an idea of where we are doing the simulations. So we've checked points along this and along that axis and to understand what happens. So we see a first order phase transition at some value of a k critical here, somewhere here. And what we then want to understand is what the geometry in these two phases is. And it turns out that interesting physics is found in the phase of low vertex density. So that's the kind of order parameter we're looking at in order to understand this rough phase structures. N naught, the number of vertices divided by N3, that's the total number of three simplices in the triangulation. So we can ask, now, what happens to foliation, which I had in the standard CDT picture? Now, it turns out that depending on where you are in your parameter space, the system dynamically really wants to be foliated. And that is in particular true when we near one of these kinematical kind of phase boundaries for alpha, where some of these inequalities get maxed out. So near one of them, the geometry is actually almost perfectly foliated. Now, what you see here are really numbers of tetrahedra at a certain time distance. And the way this funny shape comes about is that you have different types of tetrahedra, and in the strictly foliated case, they arrange themselves in very specific patterns, which I know I don't have time to get into. Now, so this happens. This is a function of alpha. You see multiplicities of the various building blocks. You won't remember what they were from my previous slide, but the ones in green are the standard CDT building blocks, and the red ones are the new ones. So here you see, approaching this kinematical boundary, the new ones basically fade away, and I only work with the standard CDT ones, and it turns out that these guys vanishing from the triangulation is equivalent with having a strict foliation. Now, what happens when we move around, we change this alpha, this kind of gets washed out, you know, this tetrahedral distribution. Now, that's a qualitative way of understanding, you know, where is there a, you know, residual, is there still a trace of foliation? And so that tells you that degree of foliatedness differs quite strongly throughout my phase diagram. Now, more interesting is what happens now as a function of inverse Newton constant, because that's really the constant which determines here in which phase I sit. And here you see the multiplicities of the various building blocks. The green ones are my all things. And in the nice phase now, there's a good mixture of all of them. When I cross over to the not-so-nice phase, well, the old ones are kind of definitely in a minority. The question now is, what is the physics here, and what's the physics there? So here's the phase transition. And how do we understand what the physics is? And here we turn to our usual way of characterizing things by looking at volume profiles. So the volume profiles are really the averaged the two-dimensional volumes as a function of time. The time is now my newly introduced time, which I explained to you on one of the previous slides. And what I now do is that for various total three volumes, I now plot the expectation value of these. And I do it first in the nice phase for small k, below k critical. And you see, for various volumes, I get these nicely, these kind of blob-shaped curves. By finite size scaling, I can map them onto each other, and what then emerges is a dimensionality for these. So if you see here, I'm rescaling T by some power of the total three volume, 1 over D namely, and I'm doing the same with N2. And it turns out now that D is in the ballpark of 3, so dynamically extracted from this. So that's a first qualitative idea. What happens beyond the phase transition is something completely degenerate. So you cannot read the axis labels here, but this is T. This goes from minus 1500 to plus 1500, so it's huge. Each dot, you know, is a kind of a slice, if you like, but it only extends to volumes of 4, 6, 10. So what this is a very long one-dimensional tube, which has, of course, absolutely nothing to do with 3D geometry. So this is my nice phase, I conclude, and this is my not very nice phase. And if I had more time, you know, I would let you contemplate on the distinctions between EDT, the old dynamical triangulations, the Euclidean signature, where you don't see any extended geometry either, and the CDT picture where we find exactly an analogous nice phase, but here we have an oscillating phase. So this has gone away in favor of a long, thin stick. So my one to last slide here. I'm, of course, again interested in identifying what this blob shape is. And what I do is I really compare it to De Sitter space. So here is my De Sitter line element in Euclidean signature and with respect to proper time. And it has, this characteristic cosine structure here. The question is, can I retrieve this from my data? Can I see that in the nice phase of this new non-foliated CDT is present? And the answer is yes. And here, I'm just giving you two snapshots measured where I compare cosine squared theoretical curves with simulation data. And you see in both cases, they fit very well. Of the fitting curve, of course, you should ignore the little bits outside the zeros of one period, of a half period of the cosine, because, well, that's, of course, not, the physics goes only to here. But what you can see here, apart from little tails that develop depending on where you sit as a function of k, these fits are almost perfect. So I conclude that what I see here is the same, really, the same kind of large-scale geometry I saw in foliated CDT. So in summary, what I did is to get rid of the preferred time and associated foliation of the standard CDT formulation while maintaining a well-behaved local causal structure. I found a characteristic two-phase structure, as in the usual CDT diagram, as a function of the inverse Newton constant. I find a nice physical phase, and here we saw a range of degrees of foliatedness of this simplicial geometry, kind of strong to weak, in some cases kind of barely visible, but quite independent of that, the volume profiles match very well that of the Euclidean de Sitter universe. So this strongly suggests the following. Of course, this is done in 2 plus 1, but for all the similarities that we know, our best guess is that in 3 plus 1, likely something similar will happen. If this is indeed the case, we would have shown that this distinguished foliation is not actually an essential part of CDT's background structure. And that makes it then somewhat more unlike Rojava-Lifshitz gravity, where such a preferred foliation is definitely very important. So the two models, non-foliated and foliated CDT, at least for the sake of this nice phase, one would conjecture, therefore, to lie in the same universality class and describe the same physics. Of course, I mentioned originally, not having the foliation is actually highly inconvenient and causes you a lot of trouble and work. So if you relied that this statement is actually true, you may actually want to stick with the usual formulation of CDT quantum gravity and make your life just that little bit simpler. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we have time for two very, very short questions.
I have a double very short question, which counts as one. no, it's in fact, it's double. First one is, in Paris, a few weeks ago, you gave an announcement about the second order phase transition in four dimensions. Where is it gone? Is it there?
That is a result. There's a paper published in 2011. So I haven't, it's still there, of course. What do you mean?
Second order phase transition in four dimensions is still there?
Of course it's still there.
And the other question is, the first time I heard this. And can you go to the slide at the beginning when you said the first with a picture, when you said the CDT is the only approach
yes.
to quantum gravity?
Yes, what was your
comment?
Sure.
It's the very beginning.
Here we go.
Yeah, CDT is currently the only candidate quantum theory of gravity which can generate dynamically a space-time with semi-class. I never understood this sentence. You always make this claim in talks. I don't understand it for various reasons. Apart from the only candidate quantum gravity that generates dynamic space-time, I mean, there are other approaches to quantum gravity which can claim much more, I would say. But specifically in this sense,
I'm making
in this
a very specific
sense,
claim. I'm not
I, what I don't understand is is what you mean. I mean, the fact of having a sum where somehow numerically you can show that if you fix the volume and the sum is dominated by large configurations, it seems to me pretty an impressive result and far from being something that you claim dynamically generation of space-time.
I feel this would have to be a longer discussion, but the only thing I'm claiming is that I'm getting something that has a shape which I can match. And I'm claiming this is a highly non-trivial result and nothing like, I mean, it's, and as we know, I mean, these are full of pitfalls, these non-perturbative models, in the sense that we know they tend to degenerate. And nothing like extended classical geometry comes out. Although initially it's difficult to understand why not. But for entropic reasons, and for reasons that curvature fluctuates very highly, typically in these models, it just doesn't happen. And here there is a proof of principle that if you choose some parameters and ingredients right, it does happen. So I would expect that is something that one can also see in other approaches. I just haven't seen it derived in this manner.
Yeah, this is just a comment about the choice of the local choice of how the light cones are.
Yeah.
And that is that if you included topology change, we know that Lorentzian cobordisms have these different light cone structures like the trousers topology.
Yes.
So it seems that within your structure, if you just added that in,
yes,
you might be able to incorporate topology change in any dimension by just allowing these light cones to have slightly more complicated structures.
Well, perhaps. So in general, you can always ask the question, now I modify my ensemble somewhat, let me repeat everything I've done, what will be the result? Here, I mean, you have to distinguish, however, between, you know, allowing local topology changes and actually then also allowing not just the things to split, but to remerge. And then immediately you are in the trouble zone of, you know, attempting to do sums over topologies, which maybe you guys are ambitious enough to tackle, but are not really well defined within this framework. So there are two divergences in the state sums.
Let's thank our speaker again.